We live in, I think we could all agree, slightly troubling times. There's a growing sense that the way we live, our cities, our environment, may not be fit for future human purpose. Now, I wonder sometimes whether we're so set in our way of being, so sort of trapped in this constant present that we find it difficult to imagine a way of living, well, a way of living better. And it's important. 70% of the world will live in cities by 2030. If we can't conceive of a better future, how do we move towards it? And this is particularly true of our cities. Do they work? Will they work? How would we change them? Here's a quote from a new book. There can be no imagination without a past. No conception of what is to come without what has already been. In this sense, history is critical as to how the imagination projects itself into the future. The desire for a good city in the future already exists in the imagination of the past. Now, the author in question is Paul Dobrychik. He is a researcher and teaching fellow at the Bartlett School of Architecture, London, author of Future Cities, Architecture and the Imagination. Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, your book opens with a great example of the collision of reality and fantasy in an urban setting. Tell us about that.
Well, it's actually a photograph of a smog-bound high-rise building in Beijing, actually, in China, although it could be New York. It looks like a kind of skyscraper that you might see in New York, but it's actually one that was recently built in Beijing. And on the side of the building is a kind of projected image of a woman's face. And this image kind of went viral a few years ago because people thought that it looked exactly like a scene from the 1982 film Blade Runner, which is seen as this iconic futuristic vision that's now, 30 years old, something like that. And it kind of pictures a future Los Angeles. And I think people were kind of seeing it as quite uncanny that cities in China are now looking like what we imagined Los Angeles might look like at this point in time, but in the past. So this really odd kind of coming together of different times, past, present, and future. And I think that's what made people find this image so interesting, that it reminded them something in the past, but also it seemed somehow futuristic as well, even though it was happening now.
And that has tickled people tremendously. I mean, you talk about sort of Blade Runner tours. There's this sort of tourism around this sort of this trop delay, this sort of small triumph of possibility and imagination, which I suspect speaks to a desire in us to try and get a grip on where we're headed in our cities.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the cities that we go to, I think we already bring a kind of imagination of that city with us. And in some ways, it's what attracts us to cities. And it's usually cities that have long histories of being pictured in films or in novels, like London, Paris, New York, for example. But I think increasingly we're seeing cities being built that invite us to think about the future because they seem futuristic, even though they're using technologies that we're all very familiar with. I think it's something to do with the rate of construction and also the types of buildings. So the fact that skyscrapers are getting ever higher, and also they're being increasingly seen as objects that are attractive in their own right. So they get lit up at night. There's these amazing images of lights being used in Chinese cities that light the entire kind of network of skyscrapers in this kind of incredible display that, again, I think reminds us of futuristic visions that we've seen in films.
We do that. I was cycling along, in fact, in the pre-dawn this morning, and over to my left was the illuminated spire of a 19th century church. And I thought, okay, this is what we do to sort of, you know, signify these landmarks. And as you say, we do this in dramatic form with the buildings in our cities. We celebrate these structures. We're tremendously impressed by them.
Yeah, sure. I think there's a slightly troubling tendency at the moment in that A lot of the buildings, particularly the skyscrapers that are constructed, give us a very sort of spectacular type of feel to the city, but it's often kind of hiding what they're really about, which is a very sort of a narrow basis in private speculative money. And also they're really built for a tiny few, the most wealthy people in the world. And I think in a way, although they're very stunning, that kind of spectacle is troubling as well, because it prevents something richer, something perhaps more social emerging, which I think we're desperately in need of in terms of how we think about more sustainable futures, cities becoming more ecologically viable and also more socially just as well, I think.
Well, I think this then goes to my original point on this and the role of the imagination in that, and whether we're equipped now to see our way out of something that we're so accustomed to and structures urbanly that tend to dominate our imagination rather than let it play into a more sustainable future.
Yeah, and also I think a lot of the things that are built are kind of they overwhelm us. So they make us feel very small, particularly tall, very tall buildings. And in a way, I think that's also very unhelpful for us to feel like we're able to participate in how cities are developing. And in fact, I think it produces the very opposite feeling of kind of impotence, paralysis, all the things which I think I would say are really unhelpful in terms of how we develop cities for more and more people. So we open up cities more democratically in the future. I think everything at the moment suggests that they're going in the opposite direction.
Your book looks at in three ways in which cities, well, might transform, beginning interestingly with the unmoored city, which is a tremendous, well, in its way scary as an idea. I mean, explain that concept to us of the unmoored city, and perhaps start in that thing of a waterlogged New York.
Well, it kind of came from initially a sort of sense in which, well, a lot of the predictions about the effects of climate change are about cities being vulnerable to sea level rises. And actually 20 of the world's largest cities are extremely vulnerable to sea level rises because they're on river deltas. And these include cities like New York, Shanghai, London, Cairo as well. And actually they're cities which are likely to have to deal with either the idea of moving the entire city or of radically adapting the buildings to increasing flooding or just generally an increase in the sea level rises, which will happen whether we like it or not. It's going to happen within the next century. But certainly, I think the idea that cities need to adapt in some way really informed that first part. But it kind of got a bit broader and I started thinking about, well, actually, there are other ways in which cities can become unmoored. So one of the chapters was actually about cities actually taking off, lifting off into the air, which sounds kind of fantastical, but actually has been quite a kind of common way in which certain strands of sort of futuristic thinking about the city have imagined cities like literally taking off into the air. And one of the kind of really interesting things that I discovered was practice of, I was a contemporary architect and artist called Thomas Saraceno, who works in Berlin, but has for the last 20 years or so has been designing prototypes for what he imagines to be cities that will float in the air. And these are real structures that kind of don't actually float, but they give you the sensation of floating. So he's trying to kind of change our ideas about what might be possible by using architecture and participation of people as a way of kind of making us think a bit differently about air. Because I think we tend to assume that air is something which we can never really inhabit or know about in any kind of depth. Mm. And certainly all of our architecture that we tend to live in is very much ground-based.
But such a huge challenge in this. I mean, you said earlier in our conversation about how cities are sort of now being determined by their, you know, investment possibility. I mean, in creating, and it is urgent and very necessary that we do better with our cities, but to create some sort of new future city vision that is in some way, you know, socially beneficial, that doesn't just in perhaps an unmoored floating city leave the underclass moored in some sort of dark underworld as a consequence of this elevation of the elite.
That's often the problem with what you might call utopian visions of cities, is that they do tend to, you know, they either underplay the social aspects or they assume a certain kind of benevolent vision will emerge. Mm. And I think it's kind of important in terms of what I've tried to suggest in this book is a move towards a greater sense of participation, that we all have our own kind of fantasies and dreams about cities and where we live and how we'd like things to be. So we can produce environments that people actually are really invested in. So I think although people find certain aspects of sort of the spectacular city that cities are being kind of created now attractive, I think it's very difficult to feel completely invested in those places because we've had no part in them, and certainly we don't. Spaces don't belong to us as well.
And there is you know, possibility and promise in that. And as you point out, the things that we now see in our cities resemble very much the imaginary flourishes of the past. So that's something that we can replicate in our own moment.
Yeah, but it's interesting with the Blade Runner example that is a dystopian vision. That is a really bleak vision.
It could go that way, Paul.
It could go that way, but there's also something people find very attractive about Blade Runner. There's the sense of kind of glamour of it as well. Mm. So there's a sort of double-edgedness of what is good and what's bad. Is I think the things aren't quite as clear-cut as we like to think they are in reality anyway. Certainly when it comes to the imagination, things tend to get a bit more grey. And I find that quite interesting. I think it's a little bit provocative, but actually gives a bit more room in terms of how we can expand what those things might mean. Hmm. And I think particularly in relation to climate change, it can allow us to think about how we might adapt to otherwise bad changes that we know are going to come and we know we will have to adapt to.
Paul, thank you. It's a fundamentally uplifting vision, and we appreciate your delving into it for us.
Thank you.
Paul Dobraszczyk, you'll find him at the Bartlett School of Architecture, London. His new book is Future Cities, Architecture and the Imagination.